Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Susan Hack. We'll start with our first story on the front page, Cedar Rapids Street Progress, Residents' Top Priority, by Marissa Payne. Cedar Rapids residents want more progress on repairing local streets, even as paving for progress makes headway on repairing roads. Street repairs ranked above public safety, flood control, taxes, and job creation in the 2020 National Community Survey, with 33% of a sample of 744 Cedar Rapids residents identifying roads as their number one issue facing the city. The issue consistently has risen to the top of the list across three iterations of the survey, which was first administered in 2016, 2 years after the city's voter-approved penny sales tax-funded Paving for Progress program began to put about $18 million per year towards street reconstruction and maintenance. Residents reported split views of the city's progress on repairing roads, with 5% ranking Cedar Rapids' efforts as excellent, 30% as good, 35% as fair, and 29% rating the city's progress as poor. Cedar Rapids contracted with National Research Center to participate in the survey. Public Works Director Jen Winter said residents' opinions on the status of street repairs could be divided, because some residents may regularly travel residential or high-traffic commercial areas where there's work being done, while others may not travel routes that take them on roads being worked on using Paving for Progress funds. The city compiles annual reports and did an overarching five-year report in 2018 to keep residents up to date on how revenue from the local option sales tax, or LOST, is funding street improvements. I hope that the citizens, the residents, and the businesses of Cedar Rapids are all seeing progress and what's being able to be done, but also realize that there are still some needs out there, Winter said. Paving for Progress manager Doug Wilson said the city estimated it would take $500 million, or $50 million annually over the course of the 10-year program, to get roads to good or better condition. This means the LOST revenue the city typically receives to fund street repair projects in a given year falls more than $30 million short of what Cedar Rapids would need annually to fully fund the work. But it's still more than the $5.5 million the city used to spend fixing roads annually before the program existed. He said about 70 miles of the city's roads have been repaved through the repair initiative, which is in its seventh construction season and is slated to fix 150 miles of Cedar Rapids streets through the 10-year program. The city has more than 600 miles of streets. By keeping up with street maintenance before a road's condition deteriorates, he said the city saves money in the long run. Using data on information such as travel and conditions, the city updates its plan on which roads to prioritize repairing every 2 years to account for streets that need complete reconstruction, as well as those that need some more minor rehabilitation to maintain. That's part of the reason why we have to do these streets that may not look quite as bad as the other street, but it's important that we extend the life of that street, Wilson said. City Council member Scott Overland, who sits on the council's infrastructure committee, said he considered the survey results a function of the money that the city is able to put toward street repairs annually, given that Paving for Progress was intended to be a pay-as-you-go program. From a city standpoint, it makes sense that it's still a concern. But at the same time, I think we've put it out there that financially we can't do $50 million a year on streets without raising taxes. And people don't usually get too excited about raising taxes, Overland said. The city would need to ask voters in 2023 to extend the LOST, which went into effect July 1, 2014 and expires June 30, 2024, to add another 10 years to the program. Overland said he favors continuing the voter-backed program to keep funding road construction and maintenance to prevent backsliding on road conditions. He noted it also helps the city avoid racking up debt, as Cedar Rapids uses the 1 cent sales tax to solely fund street repairs. "I think it's kind of a two-edged sword," Overland said. "If it's voted down, then the streets start sliding back the other direction. Or we have to use internal money to work on streets like we used to, and have to issue debt in order to do it, which means property taxpayers are going to have to pay the interest on the principal." Pence talks great American comeback in Iowa visit. Vice President thanks workers at Forest City plant. By Jared McNett, Ashley Stewart, and Grace Zaplatinsky. During his visit to Winnebago Industries in Forest City on Tuesday afternoon, Vice President Mike Pence wasn't shy about calling the RV manufacturer a crucial part of the Great American Comeback, around which President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign has framed its re-election bid. At least a half dozen times, Pence, who was joined by Governor Kim Reynolds and State Senator Randy Feenstra, used the phrase while also thanking the 200 to 250 socially distanced Winnebago employees who turned out to hear him speak. "The comeback today would not have been possible without your work," Pence told the crowd, which included former Iowa Speaker of the House Linda Upmeyer, Republican from Clear Lake. Through May 2020, the national unemployment rate is at 13.3%, which dropped from 14.7% in April. In mid-April, Winnebago laid off 79 employees due to the COVID-19 crisis, affecting the demand for the company's products. Before his speech, Pence toured the facility with Reynolds and Jim Mullen, Deputy Administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. When Winnebago decided to shut its factory in late March, Winnebago Industries President and CEO Michael Happy said one of the first phone calls he made was to Reynolds. "I wanted her to know firsthand how serious of a decision this was for us as a major employer in the state to care for the safety of our employees." Happy recalled that we would work to take care of those employees from a health care support standpoint, and that we would look to reopen safely and return our team to work when the time was right. One employee at the event, Lydia Thompson, said it was good that Pence wanted to visit Forest City and see how people do things at Winnebago Industry. "I think Pence and President Trump are doing the best job they can, and they're doing a great job," Thompson said. Jonathan River, another employee at Winnebago, said he got to speak with Pence beforehand and called it amazing. Along with employees, there were also 50 protesters marching along nearby 335th Street and South 4th Street in Forest City, who could be heard during several of the quieter moments of Pence's speech. In recent weeks, the Trump administration has been criticized by some for its handling of nationwide protests that were sparked by the deaths of Black Americans, such as George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, at the hands of police. Trump has called for stronger presences from police and the military. On Tuesday morning, Trump signed an executive order that would, quote, "leverage federal grant money to encourage police departments to meet a set of standards, including a ban on chokeholds, except when an officer's life's at risk," according to NBC. Pence mentioned the signing during his Forest City speech and said the administration will continue to move an agenda that promotes public safety. Also during his speech, Pence said, "America leads the world in testing for coronavirus." You Iowa to pay up to $675 an hour for athletics inquiry. Hush Blackwell has handled high-profile sports reviews. By Aaron Jordan. The Kansas City, Missouri law firm that will investigate allegations of racism in the University of Iowa Athletics Department was paid more than $120,000 by Iowa State University in 2017 and 2018 to handle cases related to the sexual misconduct and racial discrimination. The UI signed a contract with Hush Blackwell on Friday for an independent investigation that athletics director Gary Barta said will take, quote, weeks, not months, and will focus on former football players' allegations of racist and demeaning comments made by the Hawkeye football coaching staff. The contract doesn't spell out the estimated cost of the probe, but it does say payment amounts for attorneys range from $240 to $675 per hour for partners, and from $200 to $390 per hour for senior counsel and associates. The contract doesn't say whether or how much the firm would be paid for travel or other expenses. The lead on the UI investigation is Haley Hansen, a Drake Law School graduate who specializes in education law and has experience with cases involving gender equity, sexual misconduct, and other discrimination, according to the contract and the firm's website. Hansen and others working on the review will report to Carol Reasoner, UI Legal Affairs and General Counsel. Hush Blackwell, which has 700 attorneys in 19 offices around the U.S., is a major player in high-profile sports investigations. Michigan State hired the firm in 2017 to do a Title IX review after the sexual assaults by Larry Nassar and other reported sexual assaults by former Michigan State football players, WILX News 10 reported. The Iowa State Daily reported in 2018 that ISU paid Hush Blackwell $120,325 to provide legal help on three cases in 2017 and 2018. Two cases involved women who accused ISU of violating Title IX, the federal gender equity law, in their response to reported sexual assaults on or near campus. In the third lawsuit, ISU's former Title IX coordinator, Robinette Kelly, alleged Iowa State didn't give her the proper authority and funding to investigate sex discrimination and sexual misconduct, the Daily reported. Kelly also said she was treated differently because she is a woman of color. Kelly and ISU settled two related lawsuits for $125,000 in 2018, the ISU Daily reported. From the Iowa Today section, market after dark shelved. All daytime CR downtown farmers markets will be drive-through events this year, by Allison Gowans. The remainder of the Cedar Rapids downtown farmers markets will be drive-through events this summer, and market after dark, which was set for August 22nd, is canceled, the Cedar Rapids Metro Economic Alliance said Tuesday. The Economic Alliance previously had scheduled only the June markets as drive-through after canceling a May market date in response to the coronavirus pandemic. Though state guidelines allow public gatherings of more than 10 people, the organization still would need to ensure at least 6 feet between each group or individual attending, which would be challenging at the crowded markets, the Economic Alliance said in a news release. A typical downtown farmers market seats about 14,000 attendees, and Market After Dark saw 50,000 people last year, Economic Alliance events planner Ellie Evans said. Ensuring social distancing with large-scale community events like a traditional downtown farmers market and Market After Dark would be nearly impossible. Our top priority is the health and safety of attendees, volunteers, and vendors, and our decision reflects that, she said. The Economic Alliance hosted the first drive-through farmers market June 6th, with around 430 cars driving through and about 1,400 items purchased from market vendors. After the market, some vendors told the Gazette they had sold only a fraction of what they typically do at in-person markets. The remaining 2020 Cedar Rapids Downtown Farmers Market dates are this Saturday, July 4th, July 18th, August 1st, August 15th, September 5th, and September 19th. Saturday's market will be 7:30 a.m. to noon, and the others will be 8 to 11 a.m. Customers should place orders online by 6 p.m. the Thursday before each market at cedarrapids.shopwhereilive.com. They will be given an order number and can drive through the market to pick up their purchases. No purchases may be made on site. Guidelines for farmers markets have expanded to allow all types of market vendors, including artisans and crafts. Attendees can expect to see these products, in addition to farm products and food products, starting with the July 4th market, organizers said. Honor Flight grounds rest of its 2020 trips. Four flights to D.C. being planned for 2021, by Aaron Jordan. Eastern Iowa Honor Flight has canceled its remaining flights for 2020 after a decision by the National Honor Flight Network Board of Directors last week. The decision was made to reduce the risk of spreading the coronavirus to veterans on trips to Washington, D.C. The Eastern Iowa Honor Flight will move our flights to next year, President Dick Bell said in an email. We are in the process of securing flight dates for April, May, September, and October 2021, he said. The Honor Flight takes veterans and their guardians from the Eastern Iowa Airport in Cedar Rapids to D.C., where they view national monuments and are celebrated for their service. The Eastern Iowa Honor Flight accepts applications from veterans in Benton, Iowa, Jasper, Jones, Johnson, Lynn, Marshall, Powashek, and Washington counties, and Southern Tama County. Veterans from surrounding areas are welcome if they are able to fly from the Eastern Iowa Airport in Cedar Rapids. The Eastern Iowa Group has flown nearly 3,500 veterans on 38 flights, according to its website. Hart's first bill in House would be to reform it, tighten limits on members of Congress becoming lobbyists, other conflicts, Democrats says, by James Q. Lynch. Iowa congressional candidate Rita Hart is calling for reforms that she contends are necessary for addressing corruptions and, quote, reinvigorating our democracy. To make progress on the issues we all care about, health care, jobs, justice, public safety, and education, we need to fundamentally change how Washington does business so every voice can be heard, said Hart, a six-year state senator now running for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District seat. Too often in Washington, the loudest and most powerful voices drown out the rest of us, because special interests use money and influence to stymie progress, she says in an essay posted at Medium.com today. If elected, Hart writes, she will be a strong, caring, and independent voice to bring about real change, to provide real solutions to our toughest challenges for voters in the 24-county Southeast Iowa Congressional District. Hart, 64, a farmer and 20-year educator from Wheatland, who is running for the seat now held by retiring Democratic Rep. Dave Loebsack, will face Republican State Senator Marionette Miller Meeks, 64, of Ottumwa. Miller Meeks said she welcomed Hart's concerns about what Iowans have known for a long time. Quote, Washington is broken, dysfunctional, and corrupt. That begs the question, why does she support Nancy Pelosi and the coastal elites who believe Washington should have more power and control over our lives? Miller Meeks said. Hart's reform plan is a result of one of the most common things she hears on the campaign trail, a desire for reform and change, said her campaign manager, Zach Munier. Hart, who has been endorsed by End Citizens United, a political action committee that takes its name from the Supreme Court decisions that loosened regulations on campaign spending for corporations and unions, wants to prohibit members of Congress from becoming lobbyists and ban owning individual stocks or serving on corporate boards that could lead to conflicts of interest. Hart favors a, quote, no budget, no pay law to withhold congressional members' pay until they pass a budget. She also wants changes in redistricting to prevent gerrymandering, expand voting by mail, and overturn the Citizens United decision through legislation. Politics should always be about putting people first, and that's why I want the first bill I vote on to be tackling political corruption in Washington, Hart said. Although the candidates agree Washington corruption is a problem, the election will offer second district voters a clear choice, Miller Meeks said. Anyone who wants more dysfunction and corruption should vote for the people who want more money and power, concentrated in Washington, Miller Meeks said. Anyone who believes it's time for a fresh, new approach and that Iowans make the best decisions about their lives should vote for me. Reynolds confirms executive order to restore felon voting rights. Governor says she will sign order before November election. Governor Kim Reynolds confirmed Tuesday she intends to sign an executive order that would automatically restore voting rights to felons, and she will do so before the November general election. Iowa is the only state that automatically denies felons the right to vote. We're working on that right now, sitting down with various groups, listening to what they think is important that is contained in that executive order, Reynolds said at an informal news conference recorded by Mason City radio station KGLO. Then I have my legal team working on it, she said. Reynolds was in northern Iowa, first to tour a site in Osage where the state is offering coronavirus tests, and then to meet with Vice President Mike Pence, who toured a Winnebago Industries factory in Forest City. The governor said she has told lawmakers before their resumption of a coronavirus-shortened legislative session that she was working on an executive order to restore felon rights, voting rights. Such a move is essential, she said, given the importance of the general election in November. She asked lawmakers last year and this year to approve putting a constitutional amendment before voters that would automatically restore voting rights to felons. However, members of her own Republican Party in the Senate declined to vote on such a proposal. Members of Des Moines Black Lives Matter insisted on meeting Friday with Reynolds, who agreed to a talk with them Monday at the Capitol. Reynolds said her discussions with advocates for changing Iowa's felon voting laws had been, quote, bumpy, but were improving. Some activists are just not familiar with who can do what and how it's implemented, how important it is to get it done right, she said. Reynolds suggested her executive order might be different from one signed by Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack in 2005, which restored voting rights to an estimated 50,000 felons. That order was reversed when Reynolds' Republican predecessor, Terry Branstad, returned to office and turned back Vilsack's action with his own order in 2011. Branstad's order once again required felons to petition the governor for permission to get voting rights back. The result was a confusing situation in which felons released before January 2011 had their voting rights restored, but after that time, people had to get the governor's approval. Reynolds said the confusion caused by dueling executive orders is why she'll continue to press lawmakers for a constitutional amendment. I think then it doesn't matter who's sitting in the governor's chair. And it's a permanent solution, she said.
Now from the Eastern Iowa Briefs section. Marion Public Library kicks off 2020 Summer Learning Program. Summer learning may look a little different this year, but the Marion Public Library's Imagine Your Story Summer Learning Program still offers plenty of opportunities for all ages to get engaged through reading and activity challenges. The program runs through July 31st, and registration is available at any point until that date. Everything can be accessed online through Beanstack. To register, go to marionpubliclibrary.beanstack.com/reader365. Anyone who finishes the program, earning 12 badges, will be eligible for a gift card drawing. All children 12 and under who track 30 days of reading will earn a certificate to collect a free book. Anyone who completes 3 reviews will be entered to win a themed gift basket. Marion Public Library also is offering weekly virtual programs and special events for a range of audiences. A schedule is available at marionpubliclibrary.org/summer-reading. Marion Splash Pads now open, but some summer events postponed. The City of Marion has announced that the splash pads at Thomas Park on Marion Boulevard and Gill Park on Hawthorne Street have opened for the season. They will be available extended hours through Labor Day, operating from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. daily. Visitors are encouraged to follow physical distancing guidance and other posted public safety guidelines. Marion's playgrounds and other outdoor facilities opened on June 1st. Park pavilion usage will continue to be handled on a first-come, first-served basis throughout the summer. Reservations will not be accepted. The weekly Marion Farmers Market at Tobe Park on 31st Street will be expanding its offerings and extending its hours beginning Saturday. The market will be open from 8 to 11 a.m. on Saturdays, and in addition to produce, baked goods, and meats, it will now offer artisan items and other handmade goods for purchase. Attendees are encouraged to wear masks and observe 6 feet of distance between themselves and others. Several events that were once part of the community's summer event schedule have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. In addition to those previously announced, the Low Park Music Under the Moon concert series and the 2020 Swamp Fox Festival have been postponed until 2021. Community event organizers are working to determine appropriate alternatives in lieu of the traditional activities. Cedar Rapids splash pads expected to open today. The Cedar Rapids Park and Recreation Department has begun to open splash pads in parks. The process to turn on 11 splash pads takes 2 days, with all splash pads anticipated to be open and working by today. While the sensors on the fire hydrants, or buttons to activate the water, will be sanitized daily, other play pieces on the splash pads will not be disinfected and the water is not chlorinated. Users are asked to use their own discretion regarding use. Splash pads will operate for more hours than in previous years. They will turn on at 9 a.m. each day and turn off at 9 p.m. Splash pad locations include Cedar Valley Park on Blakely Boulevard Southeast, Cleveland Park on 8th Avenue Southwest, Daniels Park on Oakland Road Northeast, Green Square on 4th Avenue Southeast, Hayes Park on D Street Southwest, Hitter Park on 10th Street and 14th Avenue Southeast, Jacqueline Park, the corner of Jacqueline Drive and Gordon Avenue Northwest, Knoll Ridge Park on Council Street Northeast, Redmond Park at 3rd Avenue and 16th Street Southeast, Time Check Park at 5th Street and J Avenue Northwest, Twin Pines Park on 42nd Street Northeast. Health guidelines are in place that include: maintain social distancing standards of a minimum of 6 feet between users. If you've been sick in the last 2 weeks or have a cough, fever, or other flu-like symptoms, stay home for your health and the safety of others. and people 60 years of age and older, or those with underlying conditions, should stay at home to avoid potential exposures. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Kenny Lawrence, 89, of Belle Plaine, passed away Sunday, June 14th, at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. He's survived by his daughters, Bonnie Harrison and Gina Lawrence Sokol, and sister, Betty Lawrence. He's preceded in death by his parents, his wife, Doris Lawrence, and brother, Bill Lawrence. Mass of Christian burial is 1:30 p.m. Friday, June 19th at St. Michael Catholic Church in Belle Plaine. Visitation 12:30 to 1:30 at Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service. Burial at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter, Iowa at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. Gerald Jerry Martin Shada, 75, of Center Point, Iowa, passed away Friday, June 12th at his home in Center Point. Murdoch Funeral Home of Center Point is assisting the family. Jerry is survived by his wife Martha, two sons Brian and Steve Shada, daughter-in-law Teresa, Logan, son of Steve and Teresa of Center Point. Brian of Buck Creek, Iowa, has three children living in Cedar Rapids, Matthew, whose wife is Alex, Amanda, their three children, Nikki and her fiancé, Corey, and their three children. He was preceded in death by his parents and two brothers. Jerry was born June 12, 1945, in Calmer, Iowa, the son of Joseph and Clara Shada, a graduate of Austin High School in Austin, Minnesota, and then joined the U.S. Army in 1965. Jerry held jobs in construction, Collins Radio, and for 23 years worked at Farmstead in Cedar Rapids. No funeral services are set at this time. Ronald L. Randall, Sr., 80, of Grundy Center, died Sunday, June 7th, under the care of Unity Point Hospice at home. He was born on March 6, 1940, in Cedar Rapids, at home to Lawrence, Meredith, and Leona Deal Randall. He was an avid traveler and owned his own business for 60 years, Randall's Tree Service. He is survived by his wife, Becky Randall, four children, nine grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. He was preceded in death by his parents, seven brothers and sisters, two sons-in-law, two brothers-in-law, two sisters-in-law, and one great-grandchild. Memorials can be sent to his family, 506 C Avenue, Grundy Center, Iowa, 50638. A celebration of life will be held July 18th, between 2 to 4 p.m. at Grundy Center Community Center, 705 F Avenue, Grundy Center. Celebrate Life Iowa has been entrusted with Ronald's cremation care. Michael Mike Teckow, 68, of Center Point, passed away after a brief illness on Sunday, June 14th, at Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy, Hiawatha, surrounded by his family. The family will greet friends for a drive-up visitation from 2 to 3 p.m. Friday, June 19th, in front of Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. Public visitation will follow inside the funeral home from 3 to 7 p.m. on Friday. Funeral service will be held 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 20th, at the Center Point Urbana Middle School Gymnasium, 613 Summit Street. Burial will follow at the Center Point Cemetery. Guests are respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. Mike was born the son of Priscilla McNeil and Robert Teckow on June 27, 1951, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. He graduated from Center Point High School with the class of 1969. After high school, Mike attended a mortuary school for several months and also received his associate's degree in paramedic specialty from Kirkwood College in Cedar Rapids. Mike worked for Ford Remanufacturing Company for several years. He worked as a real estate agent and became owner-operator of the 150 Gulf truck stop for several years. He was proud to be an EMT paramedic and later the CEO of Center Point Regional Ambulance Service, where he dedicated his life to serving the community for more than 40 years. Mike was a member of the Linn County EMS Association, the Linn County 911 Board, and Centerpoint Washington Township Fire Agency. Mike and Julie Caranda were married on November 26, 1983, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Urbana. Two daughters, Sarah and Rachel. Mike was a caring dad and grandfather to his daughters and family. Mike is survived by his wife, Julie, daughters, Sarah, Andy, Burns, and Rachel, Adam, Ballard. Four grandchildren, Aiden and Erie Burns, and Carson and Riley Ballard. Siblings, Sharon, Jerry Depenning, and Bob, Ann Teckow. Nephews, Jeremy, Jody, Brett, and Christopher. And uncle, Pat McNeil, and cousins. And his second family, the crew at Centerpoint Regional Ambulance Service. Mike was preceded in death by his parents, several uncles and aunts, and his cherished miniature dachshund, Emma. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Centerpoint Regional Ambulance Service. Charles A. Chuck Kreeb, 92, longtime Coralville resident and area educator, died Saturday, June 13th at the Parkview Care Center in Wellman. Chuck was born December 16, 1927 in Monticello, the son of Frederick and Mary Kreeb. Following graduation, he served in the military. Returning from service using the GI Bill, he attended and graduated from Cornell College in Mount Vernon with a degree in music education. He later earned his master's degree in education from the University of Iowa. For many years, he was a counselor at Camp Manitowish in Boulder Junction, Wisconsin. Here he met his future bride, Eunice Spearschneider, and on August 4, 1962, they were married in Watersmeet, Michigan. Mr. Kreeb, as many of his former students knew him, started his teaching career in Muscatine, teaching physics at the high school level. He and his family left Muscatine when he accepted a position with the Iowa City Community Schools, beginning at West High, but then being the first group of teachers to open Northwest Junior High School. He was here for more than 26 years before his retirement, teaching primarily music, but also classes in computers and photography. His family includes his three children, Jeff Kreeb, Jerry Kreeb, and Jenny Kreeb, nine grandchildren and one great-grandson. Chuck was preceded in death by his wife Eunice in 1983. As per Chuck's wishes, he donated his physical remains to the University of Iowa for research. Upon completion of this, graveside services will be planned at the Oak Hill Cemetery in Coralville to be announced. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in his memory to the Iowa City Crisis Center or Trinity Episcopal Church. Jenny Mary Moyle Shermer, 91, of Manchester, formerly of Coggin, Iowa, passed away Monday, June 16th at the Marietta's Place in Manchester. Private family services will take place Thursday, June 18th at Bone and Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester. Jenny was born June 14, 1929, at her grandparents' home in Dundee, Iowa, to Anthony and Floy Amers Bruggerstratt. From 11 months of age, she was raised by her uncle and aunt, Dale and Blanche Jones. She attended schools in Strawberry Point and Lamont. Jenny married Harford Moyle, and they had three sons, Dale, Daniel, and Douglas. The couple later divorced. She was united in marriage to Lee Shermer and farmed near Dundee until Lee's death in 1966. Jenny was employed at the grocery store in Coggin and then did child care in her home until she was in her 80s. She was a member of the Presbyterian Church, where she was involved in many church activities. And Jenny was ordained as an elder in 1995. Jenny is survived by her three sons, Dale Moyle of Colorado Springs, Colorado, Daniel and Marsha Moyle of Lamont, and Douglas Moyle of Port Angeles, Washington. Five grandchildren, Krista, Rick, Dustin, Michael, and Nathan, 11 great-grandchildren, and 8 great-great-grandchildren. She was preceded in death by her husband, parents, stepfather Leo Wolf, uncle and aunt, grandson Robbie Moyle, and significant other Jean Haas. Gloria Jean Pugh, 74, passed away peacefully on Saturday, June 13th, at her home in Newhall, surrounded by her family. A small private service will be held Thursday, June 18th, with family and close friends. Gloria was born on June 11, 1946, in Fort Dodge, the daughter of Bernard and Florence Lice Espinoza. After graduating high school in Fort Dodge, Gloria later met and married Gary Thurman Pugh of Melbourne, Iowa. Together, they shared many years of marriage before separating and going their own ways. During their marriage together, they had four children, raising them in Melbourne. During Gloria's time, she was known by many. Gloria was the mom who picked up kids at 6 a.m. for wrestling practice and ran the concession stand for the town league baseball team. Gloria's main career was mom and grandma, but she did work out of the home. She worked at Casey's, Donnelly's, Midwest Manufacturing, and ended her career at Walmart for the past 17 years, where she was, quote, the best cashier. Gloria was a friend, sister, aunt, and mom. She was grandma to 17 grandchildren and four, almost five, great-grandchildren. Gloria dedicated her time, even while still working full-time, to her grandchildren and her family. She made trips to baseball, basketball, soccer, games, track, cross-country meets, football games, swim lessons. Gloria is survived by her children, Teresa, Danny Bodachodsky of Tama, Tracy, Cindy Pugh of Cheyenne, Wyoming, Angie, Steve Herman of Des Moines, and Aaron, Michelle Pugh of Atkins, Iowa. Her 17 grandchildren, Teresa, Zach, Bliss, Dakota, Jensen, Tracy, Jonathan, Kale, Cade, Abby, Angie, Sonny, Silvio, Rocky, Julian, Carlo, and Luca, and Aaron, Tristan, Gabriel, and Aubrey, and her four, almost five, great-grandchildren, Mila, Stella, Raylin, Riot, and soon-to-be Landon. Gloria is survived by siblings Ginny, David, Mona, Sila, Neva, and Lucy, who all still reside in the state of Iowa. She was preceded in death by her parents, her brothers, Sonny and Roger, and twin sisters, Mary and Margaret. And now turning to sports. Doyle's exit lands fairly quietly. Hawkeye players don't have much to say about it. Public reaction from former and current Iowa football players about strength and conditioning coach Chris Doyle's resignation Monday has been curiously non-existent. Doyle agreed to a separation agreement with the school that will pay him just over $1.1 million and give his family health insurance benefits for the next 15 months. In return, Doyle has agreed not to pursue legal action against the university for possible wrongful termination. The coach had been on administrative leave for 9 days after a plethora of former African American players accused him via Twitter of bullying and racially insensitive comments and actions. Iowa has hired a Kansas City law firm to conduct an independent investigation of the entire football program and allegations of racial disparity. Three former Hawkeye players living in the area, reached Tuesday by the Gazette, said that they did not want to comment on Doyle's departure or the controversy surrounding head coach Kirk Ferentz's program. None of the former players who voiced their specific issues with Doyle have commented on Twitter, other than a, quote, cheers emoji from former running back Mike Marcel Joly that was included with a retweet of the announcement on ESPN of Doyle's resignation. Iowa has announced a committee of former players, headed by Mike Daniels, has been set up to give their recommendations to Ferentz about improving program culture and inclusivity. The independent review of the program is expected to be completed in the next few weeks. On the one hand, we don't need an independent review to tell us we have issues, Iowa Athletics Director Gary Barta said at a Monday news conference. We know we have issues, and we have begun to take steps to improve. However, the independent review is important in order to look into specific concerns that have arisen, have been brought forward. to identify or clarify, maybe expand on some of the things that we are aware of. It has been shared with me that it will take weeks, not months. No hard date on finishing. I'm sure that will depend on where it heads. Four former players expressed their gratitude to Doyle on Twitter, led by former Indianapolis Colts linebacker Pat Angerer. "There's no coach who has done more for my career and my life than Coach Doyle," Anger tweeted, with a photo of his two young sons with the coach. "Extremely grateful for all Coach Doyle did for me during my time with Iowa," former offensive lineman Cole Croston said. "Helped transform a 220-pound walk-on into a 315-pound Big Ten lineman with an opportunity at the next level. Couldn't have done it without him." Former long snapper Tyler Kluver and fellow former walk-ons Kevin Ward and Drake Kulik addressed the situation at Iowa in their popular podcast, Washed Up Walk-Ons, with all three struggling to find words to explain their conflicted feelings, while supporting all of their former teammates who have expressed their misgivings with Doyle and the Iowa program. "I owe much of who I am to Chris Doyle and that Iowa program," Kluver tweeted Monday. "Doesn't mean he's perfect, but it does mean he's important to me. I do believe now that Iowa will be better without him moving forward. I know who I think should replace him." Longtime strength and conditioning assistant Raymond Braithwaite, who is black, has taken over Doyle's duties on an interim basis. "Thank you for everything, Coach Doyle," tweeted former Iowa wide receiver Matt Malloy. "You made a lasting impact in my life. I'm proud to have called you my coach." The Big Ten Conference has announced a Big Ten anti-hate and anti-racism coalition that includes student athletes, coaches, athletic directors, chancellors, presidents, and others representing all 14 league schools. The conference also has formally launched a voter registration initiative. "The events in our country and around the world during the past few months have strengthened my fundamental belief in our need to develop tangible and actionable efforts in a collective manner and provide viable solutions addressing the issues of hate and racism in our society," Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren said. "We have the distinct opportunity and responsibility through our coalition to continually encourage, educate, and empower our student athletes as we embrace transparent and much-needed dialogue regarding meaningful issues that have impacted race relations for many years." The members of Iowa's Anti-Hate and Anti-Racism Coalition are BARDA, Barbara Burke, Deputy Director of Athletics and Senior Woman Administrator, Liz Hollingworth, Faculty Athletics Representative, Vicki Brown, Head Volleyball Coach, Roz Ellis, Assistant Women's Field Hockey Coach, Alexis Civilian, Women's Basketball Player, Fran McCaffrey, Head Men's Basketball Coach, Billy Taylor, Assistant Men's Basketball Coach, Connor McCaffrey, Men's Basketball and Baseball Player, and Julius Brents, Football Player. "Been there, done that. Kennedy pitcher tosses a no-hitter in first start of year," by K.J. Pilcher. Cedar Rapids Kennedy's Mason Bain was happy but not satisfied. His bar is set pretty high. So high, in fact, that he tossed his first no-hitter and he still felt he could have been better. The sophomore right-hander fanned 11 batters and didn't allow a hit, helping the Cougars down host Cedar Rapids Washington 10-0 in five innings last night in the season opener for both Mississippi Valley Conference teams. "I thought I did fine," Bain said. "I walked a few too many. I wasn't feeling the zone early on, but I got better as the game went on and was feeling really good." Bain overcame some early control problems, loading the bases with a hit batsman and two consecutive walks in the first. He buckled down with his second strikeout of the frame and fielded a groundout to end the threat. Even though he allowed two more free passes the next inning, Washington didn't advance a runner past second. Bain mixed in a good curveball with a fastball that hits in the mid-80s. He had three straight strikeouts at the end of the second and to start the third. Bain struck out the side around his final walk in the fourth. He said he felt like he was starting to hit his grooves. "I was super pumped," Bain said. "It felt really good." Bain closed the game with one more whiff. He said he will head right back to work, correcting on the few things he did wrong for his next appearance. "There's always room to improve," said Bain, who also had an RBI double at the plate. "I try to get better each start." The Cougars provided plenty of offense. Kennedy loaded the bases in each of the first four innings and scored multiple runs. Zach Stallman provided some punch, hitting two run-scoring doubles. Stallman finished 3 for 3 with a walk and 3 RBIs. Stallman is going to be relied on hitting in the number 3 spot. "You hope you get some hard-hit balls on a consistent basis from that person," Kennedy coach Brett Hoyer said. "He was dialed in tonight. He has to show he can follow that up game to game, week to week." Caden Wack matched Stallman's 3 RBIs, while Trenton Wheatley had 2 of Kennedy's 11 hits. "I feel very good about it," Hoyer said. "All the way around, I felt the kids did very well out of the chute." Saints back to winning ways. There may be a new normal in the way sports are conducted, but it looked like the same old Xavier Saints on the baseball diamond on Tuesday night. The defending Class 3A state champions were sharp from the start in their season opener against Cedar Rapids Jefferson, rolling to an 11-1 5-inning victory at Ken Charpier Field. With the COVID-19 pandemic pushing back the start of the season by 3 weeks, it would have been understandable if the Saints had some kinks to work out. "It was good for us to get bats going early," Xavier coach Dan Halter said. "We did a good job of executing early, and Ben Kisting was pumping strikes. It's what you look for on night one." Kisting was solid on the mound, allowing just 1 run on 3 hits in 5 innings. He struck out 8 and walked 2. The Saints scored 3 runs in the first and added 6 more in the second. Miles Bitkowski had the key hit in the inning, driving home 2 with a double down the right field line. He finished with 2 hits and a walk in 3 plate appearances, driving in 3 runs. With only 2 weeks to prepare, Halter said there was a lot of work put in by the players on their own to get ready for a season that had the potential to not even happen. "Our guys were doing their things on their own," he said. "The biggest adjustment was the fact that hitters weren't able to see live pitching until we started practice. Pitchers were able to throw during the time away. Hitters hadn't seen any live pitching since the end of last year. We didn't have the spring games, and then we had short practices, so everything leading up to this had the hitters a little behind." Xavier is coming off one of the best seasons ever. The Saints went 41-2, capping it off with a state title in Des Moines. Despite the fact many of the key performers from that group have departed, the goal remains the same for the Saints. "We keep preaching the only thing they have to match from last year is how we come to work every day," Halter said. "We have a lot of pieces, and we are still trying to evaluate how the puzzle is going to fit together." Ian Wideran had 2 of Jefferson's 3 hits and drove home the lone Jayhawk run. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Susan Hack. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.